What do you love about music?
To begin with, everything.
Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Welcome to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Tonight on the world's only rock and roll talk show, we have the Elvis, the Alpha and the Omega of modern copyright law. The state of digital music sharing will be explained to us by Lawrence Lessig, professor at Stanford University.
Exciting stuff. Plus, we have reviews of the new albums from legendary Kinks leader Ray Davies, his first solo album. 40-some-odd years, you know, in the racket. It's the first time he's ever made a solo album. And British orc pop heroes Belle and Sebastian. But first, as always, we have some news.
You smiling by my table, had a call of every woman I date. Beautiful mind and body, what a happy ending I see.
Perry Farrell with Jane's Addiction. The man who founded the world's biggest traveling rock festival in 1991, Lollapalooza. Lollapalooza just part of a big menu of rock concerts that are going to attract international attention. Now in its third incarnation as a stationary destination festival in which people from all around the world come to a central city, that being Chicago, to see the festival over a couple of days in the summer. That was the case last year, 2 days, July, Grant Park, first major rock festival in Grant Park in years, decades, and now it's back this summer, part of a huge summer calendar of rock festivals, Lollapalooza being one of the main ones at Grant Park, 3 days in August, taking over double the expanse of geography that it did.
Basically, all of Grant Park. I mean, last year it was confined to Hutchinson Field down in the southern end. This year they're going to go right past Buckingham Fountain, north to
Butler Field.
Butler Field, which is where Petrillo Music Shell is. That's a mile of music with eight stages.
That's going to be like bigger than Taste of Chicago, the mega event during the July 4th holiday when a million plus people descend upon Grant Park. They're anticipating crowds of about 225,000 people. The lineup, of course, has not been announced yet. They promise 130 bands on eight stages over those 3 days. Who those bands will be, speculation is just rampant, from a Smashing Pumpkins reunion to more diverse acts stretching into hip-hop and electronic music, which they were short on last year.
Because two local critics kind of bashed them for that issue. I have it on pretty good authority the Flaming Lips are going to be one of those acts.
Well, that's pretty exciting. In addition to Lollapalooza in Chicago, we've got not one but two festivals devoted to indie rock music, whereas there was only one last summer. That was the Intonation Festival at Union Park on the west side. Drew 30,000 fans from around the world over 2 days to see two dozen indie rock bands. This year, Intonation has split off with Pitchfork, the internet music magazine, pitchforkmedia.com. They're going to be doing their own festival. They curated last year's festival. Yeah. Is all this making sense? Intonation, Pitchfork, now two separate festivals. Once they were one, now they are two.
Well, it's a story we both wrote about in the paper a couple of weeks ago. There were three partners originally on Intonation, and Pitchfork was adding its name. Now, one partner has gone off with Pitchfork, and the other two guys are going to try to do a competing festival. Remains to be seen if that actually happens. If it does, great. Three huge festivals this summer in Chicago. What about Bonnaroo and Coachella?
Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Bonnaroo has taken a turn away from the jam band approach that has used in previous years. And now they've got not only Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and Elvis Costello as headliners, but Radiohead this summer, June 16th
through 18th. Well, some people would say Radiohead
in Tennessee.
Some people would say Radiohead is a jam band. It's just a different kind of jam band.
Bonnaroo has been one of the major draws in the South every summer. And finally, the big destination festival out west, Coachella, out in the desert, a few hours east of Los Angeles. They are going to be back for another year, April 29 and 30th. this year's headliner's not quite as enticing as past years. So far, the big names on the lineup are Depeche Mode and hard rock band Tool. In past years, they've been able to engineer some major reunion concerts, some rarities. This year, they're not quite as accomplished in that regard. I don't see anything like Iggy Pop and the Stooges reuniting on this bill.
Nothing.
I don't see New Order doing its first tour in many, many years.
Nothing very exciting. So let me get this straight. Your choices are you can go to Coachella and sit in the desert and camp.
100-degree heat,
right.
Probably.
You can go to Tennessee for Bonnaroo.
Yes.
Or you can come to Chicago for 3 days in August. You know, the jewel of the lakefront, the incredible expanse of Grant Park.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know. That thing's no contest there.
The setting alone, if the weather cooperates at all, promises to be an amazing event from that standpoint alone.
Well, we'll keep an eye on the whole concert calendar as it shapes up this summer. Here's a different news story. Kind of, we're going to be talking a lot tonight about when you're stealing an artist's work and when you aren't. In terms of the digital age, this is a different kind of story about thievery. That's the Supremes' Stop in the Name of Love. Greg and I had a chance to talk with Mary Wilson, one of the original Supremes, a couple of days ago about why she has been traveling the country singing an a cappella version of that song at various state legislatures.
Well, I was actually forced to do that because I had to prove that I was Mary Wilson.
So you did this in Springfield, and the Illinois House successfully passed this legislation. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us what the problem is and what it is you're out there fighting.
Okay. First of all, let me explain that this is really a grassroots project, and it has to do with many, many of the 50s and 60s recording artists. What has happened is that there are a lot of people going around the world, to make it simple, I guess I can just say, impersonating us.
Mm-hmm.
And they're defrauding the public because they will, on the marquee or whatever, say that they are the Drifters, or they are the Supremes, or they are whomever. It's no longer a fact where they are a tribute group. They've become the actual group. And so what we, the artists, are doing, in fact, we actually put together a group of us to try to work out this situation, because we cannot go to, there are no laws, first of all, to stop these people. So we've been actually using our own money. I spent, you know, a couple of $1 million on it. Herb Reed of the Platters has spent money. A lot of people have spent money in the court system trying to fight them to no avail, because there are just no laws. So we got together and formed this coalition, put together this legislation, and we're going state by state to try to get this bill passed, which would then make it illegal for these people to do so. And if they did, we could go to the court system and say, you know, these people are using our likeness and they're deceiving the public, and they will be fined.
You're saying there's no laws on the books to protect
you
against
laws,
that?
No laws. So that's why we've put together this legislation. It's called Truth in Music.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is this law will make it so that when they perform, they have to announce or put on the marquee or advertise as they are not the original members of the recording group.
Mm-hmm.
They are a tribute band. I mean, I can hardly work in Europe now. I used to work in Europe all the time, Japan, Australia. These people work over there all the time, constantly. You should go to Polestar and see their itineraries.
I was going to say, this is mostly overseas that's happening, Mary, and how often would you say you've seen instances of this in your personal experience?
It has really, really... I know there are 5 different groups of Supremes, supposedly Supremes, out there.
Oh, jeez.
And I do know that I've tried to work in Australia, and each time I did so, I was told, well, there was just a group of Supremes over here. Or even still, we make a lot of money. And so now these people are going out there making less money, and the agents choose to use them because they have to pay out less money.
Right.
Oh, geez. So to be clear, Mary, you don't have a problem with cover bands. You know, let's say I called a group Tribute to the Ladies of Motown.
Yes.
That's not a problem.
No. I mean, because you're not saying you're us. You're not saying that you made that music.
Right.
What they're basically doing, these people are doing, they're kind of like using our history, but they don't have the DNA.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of like that. Because you can see in Vegas, I mean, you have the Platters, the Drifters, and the Coasters working out there. Well, they're not part of the original group, but yet still the original members cannot work in Vegas.
Mm.
They're in their 70s and 80s, And this is their legacy. They shouldn't have to fight. That's their history.
Other than the fact that you've lost some dough,
mm-hmm.
That's not only taking money out of your pocketbook. That's a little piece of your soul too, I would imagine.
Well, it really is. I mean, it really hurts. It really does hurt. And I would like. I'm 62 years old, and I've had a great career. I love my career. But I don't feel like fighting right now. I want to just go out and do my gigs.
Yeah.
And I want to do my gigs where I want to do my gigs. You know, I don't want someone else coming in and cutting in on my gigs.
Well, thank you so much for giving us your time, Mary, and good luck in your fight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio.
They say they never really miss you till you dead or you gone. So on that note, I'm leaving after the song. So you ain't gotta feel no way about Jay so long. But at least let me tell you why I'm this way. Hold on. I was conceived by Gloria Carter and
that extraordinary piece of music that you're listening to is a mashup, a combination of Jay-Z's December 4th with the Beatles' Mother Nature's Son, orchestrated by one DJ Danger Mouse in 2004. An extraordinary album combining elements of Jay-Z's The Black Album and the Beatles' The White Album, and creating what he called the Gray Album. An amazing record, but you couldn't buy it anywhere.
The Gray Album is obviously a dramatic example, Greg, of what can be done with this new digital music technology, and also a dramatic example of how, arguably, our current copyright laws are preventing more of that from being done. All sorts of people are using the web to find music and download music, and they're all being painted as criminals. We wanted to try to inject some sanity into this debate, since nobody from the kid on the corner to the Supreme Court justice really understands what's going on. We have the one person who does. Stanford University law professor Lawrence Lessig is the founder of Creative Commons, an organization that's trying to improve existing copyright laws, and he's the author of three of the best books about the way the internet is changing everything in popular culture.
Professor Lessig, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out talking about this DJ Danger Mouse record, the Gray Album. It's illegal under current copyright law.
That's right. And this kind of digital remixing or mashup or a remix culture that's being encouraged by digital technologies is the distinctive feature of what these technologies will enable and encourage. And the distinctive feature of copyright law is that it is not allowed, given the architecture of copyright law as it is right now. Now, what we've got to decide is whether we want this kind of creativity stifled by the law, or whether we want to rewrite the law to protect the kind of creativity that it needs to be protected in this era and allow this kind of creativity on top of it. Now, I am a believer in copyright. I think it's absolutely essential, even in the digital age. So I'm not somebody who thinks we should abolish copyright. But I do think that copyright law, as we have it right now, was written for last century's technologies. And what we've got to do is to adjust it, make it make sense in the 21st century so that it encourages the kind of creativity the 21st century encourages.
Let's take a big step back, Professor. It was not always so copyright in music. In fact, it's like about 100 years old, right? I mean, folk songs were passed down. And the notion that this is my intellectual property and I own it and you have to pay for it if you want it, that's like brand new in the scope of time, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And this is one of the things that's, I think, most important. You know, we have this image that copyright's been around forever. And in a sense, you know, it's been around since the birth of the Republic. So that's forever for us. But the nature of copyright and the scope of copyright has radically changed over the last 200 years. And music is a perfect example. Now, I think it was a mistake that music wasn't effectively protected for many years. So it's a good thing that you give copyright to musicians. But you've got to watch the detail in the way that music gets protected. So at the turn of the century, composers of music had a copyright in their composition. But once the composer authorized somebody to record the song, anybody else in the world had the right to record the same song so long as they paid a relatively low statutory fee. This is how cover albums are mm-hmm. made. And that right encouraged lots of other artists to become musicians because they could record popular songs and then add one or two of their songs onto the album so that people began to learn their distinctive kind of creativity. And that was fundamental to the growth of music industry for most of the 20th century. In fact, in 1967, when a bunch of people came before Congress to try to get them to abolish this mechanical right. The RIAA and other music publishing companies defended the right as essential to the growth of the record industry, and they argued that it was essential that there was, quote, non-discriminatory access to the underlying creative work so that you would encourage the kind of creativity and diversity on top of it. The 21st century equivalent is sampling. Right. So you want to take a couple seconds from one song and you want to remix it with another song. Well, in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the court covering the federal court covering, for example, Ohio and Michigan, the court has held that it's piracy, quote unquote, to sample even 1 second of another recording without the permission of the original copyright owner. So you have no equivalent freedom at all, and you can't license it, it's a compulsory right to license it, to engage in the kind of creativity that's natural to this technology, even though the equivalent in the last century was both explicitly authorized in the case of covers or essentially permitted through a doctrine called fair use, if you think about the evolution in the context of jazz, of the ability to remake other people's work, or even folk music, the ability to remake other people's work. So the point is, we don't even have the same type of freedom today that we had in the 20th century. And again, that's, in my view, because we've been captured by a kind of extremism in the intellectual property regulation space that is producing the stifling of new innovation relative to existing interests of existing creators.
It's a fascinating point. Think about it, the blues musicians who with a guitar were basically consistently reinterpreting songs that had been passed down for centuries. The same song reinterpreted countless times by a guy with a voice and a guitar. And I'm wondering if it's just a matter of, you know, the courts, the people in power looking upon this new wave of technology, the new instruments of this new generation of music makers, you know, the turntables, the samplers, these kind of machines, and saying, well, that's not a musical instrument. You're not making music there. You're doing something that's somehow lesser, a lesser form of music, and therefore it doesn't deserve protection under
these copyright laws. The ruling in the famous Bismarcky case, New York rapper Bismarcky samples 3 seconds of backwards piano dissonant intro, not even the hook, to Gilbert O'Sullivan's Alone Again Naturally. And the judge who ruled in that case, he was so clueless about music and the way music is made and what music is, he had to stop at one point and ask the lawyers to define for him R&B. And then he puts out this ruling that says, and I quote Exodus, "Thou shalt not steal." And it's insane.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly the case that they look at this form of music and they don't really see it as a kind of music, right? And the thing to recognize is that every generation looks at the next generation's form of music and says, that's not real music, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're all stuck in the conservative view of our present culture. But free culture has been about the right for the next generation to make it by either demonstrating how they are really artistically creative and therefore worthy of attention, or at least having the chance to fail at making that showing. We've never used the law to block the next generation's form of creativity, but that's what we're doing in this case in particular. You know, I interviewed Jeff Tweedy about this issue in particular, and I described this decision in the Sixth Circuit that blocked the ability of people to engage in this kind of sampling. And he had an instantaneous response where he said, racism. You know, and now that's a very strong charge to make. But I think it's not racism in the sort of overt sense where you're saying I'm going to try to hold back a particular group. But it is a product of the kind of segregated cultural life that we live in. Right. So that one form of music develops that white people have in some sense no direct connection with most of the time. And they don't even recognize it as art or recognize it as creativity. But African-Americans have, you know, experience to this type of culture, which is not just happens to be art, but it's also a way of expressing and re-expressing their past that's extremely significant to them, but most of the rest of the world is just oblivious to it.
You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. We are talking to Professor Lawrence Lessig, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. Later on in the show, we have reviews of the new albums by Ray Davies and Scottish orchestral popsters Belle and Sebastian, plus a Desert Island Jukebox track from Greg.
We're going to get back to our discussion with Professor Lawrence Lessig in a moment, but first we're going to give you an example of pre-digital age file sharing, the way music has been passed down for centuries around the world, a word of mouth, troubadours going from town to town, singing their song, having someone else hear it and interpret it in their own way and make it their own song. A classic example over the last century has been the evolution of this song, In the Pines, and we're going to give you some examples of how it has evolved over the last 100 years.
To the pines, where the sun never shines, gonna shiver where the cold winds blow.
Black girl, where will you go? I'm gone where the cold wind blows. In the pines where the sun never shines, I will shiver all night through.
In the pines, in the pines, where the sun never shines, and we shiver when the north wind blows.
That is Kurt Cobain, Nirvana's late singer from 1994, MTV Unplugged version of a song that has been variously known as Black Girl, Where Did You Sleep Last Night, In the Pines, and To the Pines, To the Pines. It has been passed down for centuries. We heard versions from Bascom Lamar Lunsford, a North Carolina mountain soul singer. We heard Lead Belly's version. A bunch more, and there's footnotes at the soundopinions.com website that'll steer you through the morass of this song that has been passed down by word of mouth through the ages and reinterpreted, something that you see less and less of in this day an age of more rigid copyright laws.
Yeah, it isn't that cover songs are illegal, but in this case in particular, when you hear the Dead doing their version and Cobain doing their version, everyone was recreating that song, taking the raw material and reshaping it, which is what a lot of people say electronic artists are doing when they're sampling.
Professor Lessig is arguing the case that that kind of creativity is no longer allowed, that sense of word of mouth, reinterpretation, the consumer becoming the creator, is not allowed in this present digital age copyright law environment.
Exactly. We talked a little earlier in the conversation with Professor Lawrence Lessig about creativity being stifled, artists being stifled. We also wanted to ask him about how the consumer is being affected.
Are they consumers or creators, right? In the 20th century, I understand, they were consumers. And even the mixtape, which of course is extremely expressive, was still just taking other people's work and just reordering it. But that's, you know, a fraction of the kind of creativity that will go on in the 21st century. And when it happens, the hard question is whether the law is going to allow it. Because the reality is, as the law is written right now, this form of creativity is not legal. And, you know, why we should be rendering illegal creativity is the hard question that I think policymakers have got to think about.
Of course, there's all sorts of things, Professor, that are technically illegal but flourish in America.
Yeah. You know, and here's the boring law professor in me, right? I think it's awful that kids engage in behavior all the time in all sorts of contexts that they self-consciously know is illegal, and yet they think, well, this is just the way we live. But my response is, let's find a way to make the laws make sense with these technologies. Because the fact is, it's not that our kids are deeply immoral. It's that the law renders their behavior illegal in a way that does not make sense in the 21st century.
You know, one of the names we hear a lot about in this discussion is Napster, the first peer-to-peer applications where people would download music, or rather illegally download music according to current copyright law. Professor, you fought on behalf of Napster before the Supreme Court. Tell us a little bit about your argument.
I've actually had lots of second thoughts about what's the best strategy for arguing about this issue, because the vast majority of people, when they hear about Napster and about Grokster, hear about technologies that enable people to copy other people's content without their permission, copyrighted content. And for most people, they think that's wrong. And I understand why they think it's wrong. And in fact, I don't think peer-to-peer technology should be used to violate other people's copyright. But when I was involved...
That's a point, Professor, before you go on, we should make crystal clear. You don't think it's fair for me to log on to the computer and I don't want to buy the new Madonna album, I'm just going to download it because I'm cheap. That's wrong. Against that.
Yeah, it's wrong. I mean, I'm using as strong words as possible. It's wrong, it's illegal, it's immoral, all of that. I don't think you should do it, period. But when we were arguing about the Napster case and we were arguing about the Grokster case, the reason we supported Napster and Grokster, I supported Napster and Grokster, was an esoteric legal question. And the legal question was, should the courts or should Congress decide which technologies are allowed and which are prohibited? And the principle that I still believe in, that the Sony Betamax case announced in 1984, was that when a new technology comes along that alters the way content gets distributed, as long as it's not solely usable for illegal purposes, it's a problem for Congress, not for the courts. Now, I think that's a great thing, because the idea that a federal judge would sit there and decide which new innovations are going to be allowed and which ones are not is terrifying to me. I mean, these are like Soviet planners with better calculators and better lighting, right? I mean, it's outrageous to imagine judges involved in this process. So that's why I was animated to say, no, this is not a decision for courts. It should be left to Congress. But the problem with that argument is that, you know, 90% of the world doesn't even understand that's what the issue is about. 90% of the world thinks that when you stand up and you defend Grokster, you're defending people taking content without the permission of the copyright owner. And that's not what I'm defending. So in my view, it would be much better if we could begin to focus people not so much on the peer-to-peer file sharing problem, but on the extraordinary range of creativity that's going on out there on the internet right now, that it's also being shut down by this extraordinarily extreme system of intellectual property regulation that we've got right now.
Absolutely. Let's play devil's advocate for a moment here, Professor. The Recording Industry Association of America, which has come up several times in this conversation, dominates the $12 billion a year music industry. It produces the vast majority of music that's consumed through non-underground channels in America. They make very, very strident points. You can go to their website and they will tell you why peer-to-peer file sharing and why this internet revolution is destroying culture as we know it. And their points are it's going to drive the record companies out of business. They view each sale by a pirate referring to a peer-to-peer file share, presumably, represents a lost legitimate sale. It's going to drive up the costs of legitimate music, which will affect the consumer directly. And it will drive artists to look for other vocations that actually pay, because they're no longer getting paid. Songwriters, producers, singers, musicians are no longer getting paid royalties from these lost sales. How would you address these very passionate points that the recording industry is making about its dying business in the light of what's happening on the internet right now?
The existence of peer-to-peer file sharing at the level at which it exists right now is what is driving the legislative policy of extremism in intellectual property. It's because they can point to this behavior that they're able to get Congress to do whatever they want to expand the reach of copyright in a way that stifles new innovation. But, I mean, there's a lot of important points in what the RIAA is saying, and I don't disagree with everything that they're saying, but let's focus on, first of all, who they are. They're not the Artists Association of America.
Right.
They are the Recording Association of America, right? So they're already talking about the middleman. Now, in some sense, the middleman has never been a great supporter of the artists, right? So the publishers and the recording industry, they obviously have interests that are not necessarily the same interests as the artists. My favorite copyright scholar, Lyman Ray Patterson, he loved to say that, you know, the relationship between the author and the publisher is the same relationship as the cow to the cattle rancher, right? I mean, of course, they both have an interest that sounds some ways the same, but it's also fundamentally different. So the recording industry, you know, is it might be true that they're threatened by these new technologies, but it's not clear that abolishing the recording industry, at least in the way that we think of it today, is terrible for the artist, right? The existing industry is extremely concentrated. It's extremely narrow range of artists who actually get to make it in the world, who actually can support themselves through the sale of recordings. And a different industry might actually benefit a wider range of artists, and that would be a good thing, in my view. But if they can't provide value to artists, then they have no reason to be here in the business, because the job of a recording industry is not to protect themselves. It should be to help prosper artists in this business.
We are talking to Professor Lawrence Lessig on Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeYourgatis. My partner is Greg Kot. Professor Lessig's written three indispensable books for anybody who cares about the future of copyright and the issue of the digital domain, Free Culture, the Future of Ideas, and Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. But one thing I don't get, though, I remember being a kid of 13. I was the world's biggest Pink Floyd fan. And the night that The Wall was released, WNEW in New York City played it all in its entirety. And I sat up, starting at midnight, right? I sat up and I taped it. I taped it on my, you know, C90, right, which was the first thing that the music industry said was going to home taping is going to kill recorded music. You know, and I had that cassette, right? And it wasn't illegal for me to do that, right?
What year did you do it?
Well, the year The Wall came out, I guess.
1980 or whatever, 79?
What was that? 79-80? Yeah, 79-80.
Yeah.
You know, this is where the recording industry's right. There's a real difference between the ability to tape something off the radio and the ability to tape something in a digital form and make it available on the internet, because the first thing is a kind of second-class recording that you can share with everybody who happens to want to spend the 40 minutes it takes to dub it. But the second thing is something you can make available to your 100,000 best friends on the internet. That's a difference, right? Now, again, I don't think that it's appropriate to have the kind of penalties that are in place for that behavior. You know, the recording industry is often fond of saying, what's the difference between walking into a Tower Records and picking up a CD and walking out with it and downloading the same content on the internet? Well, there is a big difference. In California, if you go into a Tower Records and you pick up a CD and walk out, you might be chargeable with a misdemeanor that's probably a $1,000 fine. According to the RIAA, if you download the same songs off the internet, you could be liable for $1.5 million in damages. Now, you know, the point is, between the two, which is the really harmful activity, Tower Records actually deprives Tower Records of some money. But down the internet, it's arguable whether it harms anybody. So the point is, I don't think the penalties are appropriate. And what the penalties mean is that every time they sue somebody, absolutely the lawyer will say the only thing you can do is to settle.
Well, a good place to wrap up, Professor, might be whether realistically we are going to see this change in our lifetimes. I mean, you have a good read of the courts. You've argued before the Supreme Court. Where are we going and how is it going to get resolved? Are the courts going to make sense of this?
I think the place to look is not the courts. The place to look is in the computer hard drives of millions of American kids right now. Right. So the Pew Trust released a study that said 57% of teenagers – had produced and shared content on the internet. I'm not talking about peer-to-peer file sharing of illegal content. I'm talking about creating content which they shared with others. That kind of creativity is inherently unstoppable. And the only question we should answer is whether that kind of creativity will be legal or illegal. Now, I think we could craft intellectual property laws to make that kind of creativity totally legal under the law and also protect artists. But the real place to look is where that energy, that kind of creativity, is exploding, and ask the question whether our courts and legislatures will catch up to it. Now, I think eventually they will. But the problem with all wars of prohibition, which is exactly what this war is that there's extraordinary costs in the interim. And the costs are not just to the recording industry. The costs are to creators, like the samplers, who are blocked from being able to release legal content, and our kids, who are blocked from being on university networks because it turns out they had some kind of file sharing technology on their computer. There's an extraordinary number of costs here that are not being considered, and it's much more significant, I think, than the cost to a relatively small industry. You know, $12 billion industry is nothing in the scale of the United States economy,
right.
And it's nothing compared to the industry of, you know, computer technology and broadband services that could actually be benefited by a more balanced intellectual property regime.
So let's say the industry comes to its senses, Professor, and names you the head of Sony or EMI tomorrow.
Wow.
What would you do to save this dinosaur from sinking up to its neck into the tar pits of the past? What do you think it should do?
I think one thing it should do is encourage participation with the work of their artists. So I think that they should be totally open to the idea of encouraging kids to remix the creative work of their artists, at least non-commercially, right? You should be releasing your content in a way that says, you want to take this and do things with it non-commercially, remix it, that's totally fine. Now, that's different from saying you're allowed to peer-to-peer file share it. I'm not saying they should give people the rights to do that, but they should encourage the kind of creative work that the technologies are allowing. That's one. Number two, they should encourage artists to experiment with different ways of producing and sharing their content. I mean, we at Creative Commons, we had a license that encourages this kind of sampling and remixing. And Gilberto Gil, who's one of the most important Brazilian musicians, a fantastic artist, wanted to release his content under this license. And his record label wouldn't let him because they owned all the rights and they refused to allow this kind of experimentation. And if it were head of Sony or BMG, I would back away from the insanely harmful technologies, DRM technologies that they're bundling into their content, which only makes, you know, consumers more furious with their record labels, not more.
And those are the programs that make it impossible to duplicate the CD, to play it in some cases in your computer.
You know, I just don't know how a company like Sony BMG could think that they would be able to release this product, which essentially places viruses on top of computers all around the world, and get away with it.
Thank you very much, Professor. We appreciate the time this afternoon.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Lift yourself out of the doldrums. Make yourself a cup of tea. Drag your emotions out of the gutter. Don't wallow in self-pity.
Ray Davies singing about lifting yourself out of the doldrums, posing the existential question, is there life after breakfast? We're going to talk about Davies' first solo album ever in a couple of minutes. We should note, perhaps we should call him Ray Davis. Apparently in interviews now, he's decided that after 45 years of being in the pop music consciousness as the leader of the Kinks, known as Ray Davies, he would like people now to pronounce his name Ray Davis.
I'm sorry, Jim. We can't go there. He's Ray Davies to us. He's always going to be Ray Davies. Ray, it's a little too late to change the pronunciation of your last name.
On the other hand, Cott, when you wanted to be known as G. Diddy, we all went along with you. It only lasted a few days.
Well, that was one drunken night. I'm sorry. That's over. It's over.
We'll be back on Sound Opinions in a minute.
Total embarrassment to your friends and family. Get out of bed, the whole day's ahead. So
take the pills and drink your tea. Is there life after breakfast, full of possibility? Is there life after breakfast? Yes, there is after breakfast. So don't be so depressive. Is there life after breakfast? Yes, there is after breakfast. Is there life after breakfast, full of possibilities?
Welcome back to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune. My partner is Jim DeRogatis of the Chicago Sun-Times, and we're talking about the new Ray Davies album, Other People's Lives.
You know, Davies has been missing in action for some time, Greg. I reviewed him in the summer of 1996 during my brief tenure at Rolling Stone. Got him really ticked off at me. he played the Jane Street Theater in downtown Manhattan, and he was doing this storyteller series of shows where he would come out and tell the anecdotes behind the famous Kinks songs. And he worked that for about 2 years and put out a storyteller's album. But it was sad because, to me, Davies has always been one of the most poignant, insightful, funniest, and brilliant lyricists in rock and roll, able to look at society and say things about the way people live. Memorable characters. We played David Watts by the Kinks a couple of weeks ago. He's a genius, yet he seemed willing to play the role of an oldies act. He actually just told Rolling Stone, "I thought my creative days were behind me. I couldn't write songs anymore." And that's sad. But suddenly, in 2000, he moves to New Orleans, and he finds new inspiration living in America as an American, but not really fitting in, feeling much like he did early in his life, growing up in Muswell Hill, being entirely too smart than many of the people around him in London and not fitting in. And he reconnects with his muse. And he starts writing, and he starts recording demos, finishing some songs that had been laying around for years, writing other ones fresh. And then he gets shot. You know, he and his girlfriend were walking on the street. She was mugged. Her purse was stolen. And he chased the mugger. Not always a good idea to do. And he wound up getting shot. And that accident apparently gave him the impetus to finish the album. And now, after never having released a solo album through all of his history, after the Kinks not being heard from since 1993's Phobia, Davies has this new record.
We're going to tell you what we think about this album in a minute. But first, Jim, let's play a track. What are we going to play from Other People's Lives?
I thought we'd play the title track, Greg. I mean, because Davies has been tabloid fodder for much of his life. And here is one of those great subgenre of rock songs, Hating the Press. You know, I always want to give the rock stars equal time. You know, we take shots at you. You can take a shot at us. This is a great anti-press song, Other People's Lives, the title track.
Can't believe what I just read. Gossip on the internet. Now the tabloids have the news. Cross my heart, it just ain't true. I never thought it of you. Name names and every line is feeding their suspicious minds. I'm not bitter or angry. I'm only feeling sympathy. You really found the time to feed the reporter.
That's Ray Davies, the title track, Other People's Lives, from his first solo album on Sound Opinions.
Jim, you've talked about the eloquence of Ray Davies as a songwriter, and there's no doubt that as a songwriter, he's still as strong as ever. I love the character sketches on this record. I love the fact that he weaves those character sketches into sort of a loose narrative about his life, about transformation. He talks about right at the top of the record, things are going to change, this is the morning after, my life is moving on. And he ends the album, or the penultimate song on the record is a song called Over My Head, in which his journey seems to have come to an end. You know, didn't know you were close to breaking, so you thought it should end, left it all for a new location so you could start again, this whole idea of transformation in this record.
Yeah.
Again, wonderful, thoughtful, literate lyrics, and at the same time, I found the production and the sound of this record kind of dull.
Hmm.
Kind of just sat there for me. I never sensed that.
Well, what about the horn section? I mean, there's some spark there.
There, you know, stand-up comics got this sort of jazzy kind of feel to it, and I thought immediately of the influence that this guy has had, you know, on a band like Blur, for example.
Blur, oh, yeah, or The Streets. He's delivering it in this Cockney accent.
Absolutely.
Like the English rapper, The
and
Streets.
And it's wonderful.
Well,
I
know where you're going.
I sort of felt this was Davies by numbers in terms of, okay, let's do a little bit of this genre and a little bit of that genre.
The melodies
and
are strong.
The
distinctiveness
is not there that I expected musically of those great classic Kinks albums. And let's face it, Jim, this guy's got a monument standing behind him. Those classic Kinks albums are a lot to live up to, and I just don't think the spark musically matches the spark that he had lyrically for this record.
You see, you're talking around, and what you really mean to say is you want to hear the fuzz guitar of his brother Dave. It's a classic sound, and I don't blame you.
Yeah, I just want to hear a sound that sounds like a bunch of studio pros sort of piece this record together with Pro Tools. I want to hear a rock band on fire behind him, and whether that's slow, in between, or ultra fast, I just don't feel like these guys were invested in this record as much as Ray Davies was.
Well, I really disagree with you on that. I think it's a better record than you're saying. I think he is playing it passionately, but it ain't a Kinks record, you know. But let's not forget the last 10 years of the Kinks career, the Kinks weren't really so good at being the Kinks anymore. You know, yeah, I would like to hear him playing with his brother. He's been hinting in interviews that there may be a Kinks reunion. But, hey, I'm glad to have him back, Greg. And I think this is definitely a buy it record. I mean, give it to the old geezer, will you?
I definitely think it's worth burning. There's some great songs in the classic Ray Davies tradition on this record, but I can't not recommend it as a buy it at all. Because, again, I feel the music falls short, so it's a burn it for me.
Wow.
Look at the kid from school. He's teaching mamas and papas how to be a little cool. He's changing fashion the way he dresses.
That is Belle and Sebastian, the Scottish orchestral pop band, showing some uncharacteristic toughness on that track from their new album, The Life Pursuit, the seventh studio record from Belle and Sebastian. You know, Jim, if the word twee hadn't been already invented, they would have had a picture of this band next to it in the dictionary.
Well, indie rockers are so fond of coining genre names. Some people call Belle and Sebastian the kings of twee pop.
Yes, dainty, quaint, sweet. Some people love them for those qualities. Other people absolutely abhor them because they are just too soft and too precious. The one thing I've always admired about this band, though, is the songwriter, Stuart Murdoch. Beneath that soft voice and those very pop-oriented arrangements are some really acerbic and observant lyrics. And he gives these songs sort of a bittersweet twist. Here's a guy who clearly has seen himself as an outsider throughout his life. And he's not only wrestling with the world as we know it, but also with how he fits in to that world, how God fits in, and how he fits in with God. Some of the words that he's written about his relationship to this higher power: I gave myself to God. There was a pregnant pause before he said, okay. not even sure if God likes him, you know?
Yeah.
So he's wrestling with these kind of issues, and in a very funny way, in a very cynical way, which runs counter to the way the music actually sounds. I thought their first couple of records were terrific, in particular their 1996 album, If You're Feeling Sinister. The problem is, the album started to sound more samey, the approach lost its freshness, and they'd started to sort of wear out their welcome. They made kind of a smart move in 2003 with the Dear Catastrophe Waitress record, when they hooked up with a very unlikely producer, Trevor Horn, who instantly gave them much more of a heftier sound, more of a pop sheen, and that was sort of a semi-comeback. And now we have The Life Pursuit, again done with a pretty highfalutin L.A. producer-type guy named Tony Hoffer, who worked with Beck on Midnight Vulture. So again, Belle and Sebastian veering away from that sort of orchestral pop sound and getting a little tougher, introducing some soul elements, some disco elements, some giddiness to the record so they don't sound quite so morose and so sad and so fey anymore. A good move on their part. Here's an example of what I'm talking about, a track that sort of finds Belle and Sebastian going disco. I mean, who knew? It's called We Are the Sleepyheads on Sound Opinion.
Belle and Sebastian, We Are the Sleepyheads, from their seventh album, The Life Pursuit. Greg, I'm with you. I'd given up on Belle and Sebastian. I'd written them off. But what's good about this record that wasn't on the Trevor Horn album, the last one, yeah, the production was getting a little tougher, but the tempos were still so slow.
Mm-hmm.
And the tempos here, I mean, this is positively, if you compare them to the earlier records, this is Belle and Sebastian on 45. You're playing a 33 RPM on 45.
Right.
All of which is fine for me, because they're laughing at themselves. There's good humor. There's incredible hooks. There's his cynical, sarcastic vocals and lyrics, and there's rhythms.
Yeah, I never thought I would find myself liking, let alone loving, another Belle and Sebastian record. And when I first put this on, I thought, oh, you know, it sounds like them. But then I realized and heard these kind of supercharged soul, pop, disco melodies. I mean, they're clearly mining the 70s for everything they're worth, you know, in terms of sound and inspiration. Really surprised me, and the energy surprised me. At the same time, it's interesting how Murdoch has resolved his religious issues in this record, Stuart Murdoch, the songwriter. Instead of being rejected by God, he's finding God in the music. You know, it's kind of like my Damascus Roads, my transistor radio.
Oh, there
you
go.
The 70s AM bubblegum pop will save you. And he's giddy with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an upbeat, energetic Belle and Sebastian record. What a late career surprise. But Belle and Sebastian has done it on the buy it, burn it, trash it scale we use here at Sound Opinions. I'd say it's the first Buy It Belle and Sebastian record in a good long while for me.
I'm with you, and I never thought I'd say that. I'm not supposed to be the twee guy, but I'm all over Belle and Sebastian. Buy it.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Every week on Sound Opinions, we choose a song from the Desert Island Jukebox. Greg Kot, it is your turn. What do you got?
You know, Jim, Lawrence Lessig has completely inspired me tonight, and I realized how ticked off I am about the fact that records like the one I'm going to be playing tonight can't be made anymore because our copyright laws prevent it from happening. Hip-hop artists for about a decade were basically creating new wonderful music out of samples, bits and pieces of electronic data from records that had been recorded years before. The entire history of recorded music was at their fingertips, and they were able to recreate that history and make new music out of it. The Beastie Boys did an incredible job of it on Paul's Boutique, their 1989 album. And that really was the last of an era, because after that, the lawsuits started piling up and it became prohibitive for hip-hop artists to sample other people's records and create new music out of it because they had to pay through the nose for it. Some of these samples costing hundreds of thousands of dollars and really ended an era. And I think the height of that era was Paul's Boutique. What was extraordinary about this album was the Beastie Boys, these three guys who had been called... Their debut record, Licensed to Ill, was sort of regarded as a fluke by critics. I remember the headline in the Village Voice, something like, Three Idiots Make a Masterpiece. Like,
yeah.
This will never happen again. These guys won't have a career.
Yeah.
It was basically songs about drinking, partying and drinking
yeah.
over kind of stock beats and heavy metal sounds.
But these guys really weren't artists. Well, Paul's Boutique proved that they were artists. They collaborated with this Los Angeles production team known as the Dust Brothers, three guys named Matt Dyke, John King, and Mike Simpson. And these guys were ahead of the curve in terms of taking samples and blending them together. They were sort of the West Coast version of the Bomb Squad, the groundbreaking hip-hop production crew that was working with Public Enemy on the East Coast. Well, the Beastie Boys answered Public Enemy's extraordinary facility with sampling with Paul's Boutique, and in particular the song Eggman. You've got snippets of Dance to the Music by Sly and the Family Stone. You've got not one but two samples from Public Enemy. You're Gonna Get Yours and Bring the Noise. You've got the bass line from Superfly by Curtis Mayfield. You've got a bit of Bernard Herrmann's score from the movie Cape Fear, the original Cape Fear. You've got a scream from Drew Barrymore in E.T. You know, the big beat in that track is a kind of an obscure reference. It's a song called Sport by the artist named Lightning Rod from his album Hustler's Convention. You've got bits of Jaws and Psycho, and you've got some of Tower of Power's Drop It in the Slot. So you've got basically this gamut of movie soundtracks, movie dialogue, great soul, hip-hop, and funk, all blended together. Basically, no real instruments were used, no traditional instruments, guitar, bass, drums, just a great piece of music created out of other pieces of already recorded music and three voices on top of it. You can't do that today. The Beastie Boys, end of an era, and I'm really kind of sad that it's gone. Eggman, my Desert Island Jukebox pick on Sound Opinions.
He had no hair.
Lost that shot, he was caught out there.
Saw the convertible driving by. Loaded up the slingshot, let one fly.
He went for his to find, he didn't have one. Put him in check, correct, my egg gun.
The egg, a symbol of life. A course that died to bust out to white.
I pulled out the gem, he thought it was a joke.
The trigger,
I pulled his face,
the yolk.
Reached in his pocket, took all his cash.
Left my man standing with the egg mustache.
Suckers, they come, a dime, a dozen.
That was Eggman from the Beastie Boys, my Desert Island Jukebox pick for this week.
Good choice, Mr. Cott. That is a psychedelic hip-hop classic. I think in a lot of ways, hip-hop still hasn't reached that level of creativity.
That route of creativity has been cut off, and that's tragic, I think.
Absolutely.
Jim, next week I think we've got a great show. We're going to have indie rock chanteuse, and I love the sound of that. Feist in here with her guitar. Really looking forward to that next week.
Absolutely. On the way out, we'd like to thank our two guests, Professor Lawrence Lessig and Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and our usual staff and bosses, Tori Malatia, our executive producer, Todd Bachman, our managing producer and director, Matt Spiegel, our producer, Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn, our associate producers. Joe Dassault gives us a lot of technical help, and Greg, we've been remiss in forgetting to thank Dino Armiros, our attorney, who's done a lot for us, and also we may need bail someday, so you just can't forget him. Thank you very much for listening to Sound Opinions.
We'll talk to you next week.